Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Gavin, and I'm reading the Big Bend Sentinel, published Wednesday, March 17th, 2021. Luciana P. Leyva. Enveloped by the love of family, Luciana P. Leyva of Alpine, Texas, passed away on March 6, 2021, at the age of 81. Catholic services were held in Alpine on March 11th and 12th, and she will be laid to rest on Tuesday, March 23rd, at the Dallas-Fort Worth National Cemetery. It is appropriate, even poetic, that Luciana exited the world under the devoted vigilance of her children, given her sheer dedication to them her entire adult life. From the moment she became a mother for the first time, she threw herself into providing and caring for them and shaping their moral values. Due to the problem of her first marriage, much of it happened as a working single mother, a challenge she often looked back on with a sense of accomplishment and a deep gratitude to God, whom she credited for her unflappable faith and fortitude she developed as a result. Surviving family members include her husband, Palamon R. Leyva, and 7 of her 10 children and their spouses, Jose Olivas, Robert Olivas, Maria M. Olivas, Maria R. Olivas, Abel Olivas, Tino Olivas, and Jesus Olivas. She also leaves behind another daughter-in-law, Selena L. Olivas, and several grandchildren and great-grandchildren, in addition to siblings, nieces, nephews, cousins, an aunt, and many friends. In the minds and hearts of all of them, Luciana lives eternally as a pillar of strength and love. Roberto Beto Garcia. Robert Garcia died March 11, 2021, in his home surrounded by his wife and children. He was born August 13, 1930, in Fort D.A. Russell Hospital in Camp Marfa. He was the son of Bernardino Garcia and Jesusita Molinar. He was married to Rosie Alidia Morales on November 6, 1960. Robert's passions were music and carpentry. He was often found playing the guitar either by himself, with his son Bobby, or his brothers. He and his brothers were known to serenade their mother on Mother's Day and anyone else that would listen. His love for carpentry led him to build amazing things, such as his family home in which he lived, cabinets, and many things around town. He was a member of the Knights of Columbus, was in the army during the Korean conflict, and was retired from the Border Patrol. He is survived by his wife, Rosie Garcia, his brother and sisters, Catalina Kate Wright, Socorro Cocoy Munoz, and Victor Garcia, his children Robert Bobby Garcia Jr., Rita Marie Garcia, Ruben Garcia, and Rose Belen B. Garcia, his 14 grandchildren, his 23 great-grandchildren, and many nieces, nephews, godchildren, and friends. He will also be greatly missed by his partners in crime, his dogs Peanut and Hobo. Alvin Keith Jarrett. It must be nice to be Mr. Jarrett, his wife would say. He agreed. It was, until it wasn't. Alvin Keith Jarrett, 72, went to his heavenly home on March 10, 2021, at his home in Fort Davis, following his battle with pancreatic cancer. Keith was born September 25, 1948, to Alvin Art Jarrett and LaRue West Jarrett in Lorain, Texas. His grandparents, Lester Lee Jarrett, May Reeder Jarrett, J.W., and Trixie West, all of Lorain, were important to Keith and influential in his upbringing. Keith lived more than 70 years in what he lovingly referred to as his earthly paradise, Fort Davis, Texas. He attended elementary school through the high school in the Fort Davis Independent School District, graduating in 1967. He attended 2 years at Sul Ross State University in Alpine, Texas. Keith dearly loved his 3 children and 9 grandchildren, daughter Dusty Jarrett Bartolazzi and husband Amori, grandsons Kaysen and Turner of Magnolia, Texas, son Wesley Lance Jarrett, grandchildren John Wesley and Amelia Margaret of Fort Davis, Texas, daughter Annette Jarrett Barraza and husband Eddie, grandchildren Maria, Vincent, Avery, Cy,
in Kelston of Alpine, Texas. Keith is also survived by his stepmother, Mary Ann Jarrett of Fort Davis, brother J.L. Jarrett Sr., and wife Maribeth Jarrett of Fort Davis, Steve and sister Jan Jarrett Jacobs of New Braunfels, Texas, Johnny and cousin Myra Harvey of New Braunfels, nephews J.L. Jarrett Jr. and wife Audra of Justin, Texas, Brian Jarrett and wife Melissa of Fort Davis, and Bart Jarrett of McKinney, Texas. Keith loved the Lord Jesus Christ and strived to serve him as a member of his beloved First Baptist Church, serving as a trustee, deacon, choir member, and on multiple committees throughout his 61-year membership. He also served his local community as a FDISD school board member for 18 years and as a member of the Jeff Davis Community Appraisal Board. However, of all Keith's accomplishments, his greatest desire for his legacy was to share the love of Christ. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. John 3:16. The family wishes to express its appreciation to Dr. Jim Luick, Rebecca Lewis, NP, Kathy Duncan, NP, Meredith Ilmer, PharmD, and to the other healthcare professionals, Connie Cornett, Jess Williams-Jones, Yolanda Molinar, Crystal Bentley, Andrea Lara, and Rosalinda Jordan for their care and support. A memorial service was held at First Baptist Church, 101 South Agave, Fort Davis, Saturday, March 13, 2021 at 2 p.m., with burial at Hillside Cemetery, Fort Davis, Texas. In lieu of flowers, memorials slash donations may be made to First Baptist Church of Fort Davis, Texas, P.O. Box 809, Fort Davis, Texas 79734. Services were entrusted to Alpine Memorial Funeral Home.
Sheriff's Office says avoid IRS scam phone calls by Big Ben Sentinel. In spam calls received by local residents from numbers that appear to be local, scammers are referencing the latest IRS stimulus payment and asking residents to share bank account numbers and other sensitive information. The Presidio County Sheriff's Office is asking residents not to share sensitive information over the phone. The IRS will not be making phone calls regarding the stimulus. The Sheriff's Office says residents should never give out bank account numbers or other financial information over the phone. As pandemic in Texas hits 1 year mark, a look back at a history-making year by Stephen Paulson. Even as a growing number of locals get their vaccines, Texas and the Big Bend are reaching some grim milestones in the fight against coronavirus. A year ago on Monday, on March 15, 2020, Texas saw its first confirmed death from coronavirus. More than 45,000 Texans have died since then, including at least 39 in the Tri-County, according to records from the Texas Department of State Health Services. The pandemic arrived relatively late in the Tri-County, with the first confirmed case showing up in Brewster County around late April. Regardless, it's been just around a year since the first waves of dread started hitting the region. Last March 12th, many businesses in Marfa, including Do Your Thing, Stellina, and Capri, started to either close or switch to to-go only. The Big Bend Sentinel started operating remotely on that day. Marfa instituted a shelter-in-place order on March 27th, Presidio, Brewster, and Jeff Davis counties all issued temporary bans on short-term rentals, a rare sign of unity in an era often racked by partisan division. It wasn't long, though, before debates over coronavirus restrictions turned partisan in the Big Bend and across the country. In April, Governor Greg Abbott barred local governments from passing mask rules and other protections. The policies changes prompted some local outrage, with one Presidio official complaining that the state viewed Presidians as dispensable. In addition to mask rules, Abbott's order also prevented towns like Marfa from keeping its hotels and Airbnbs temporarily shuttered. In May, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported, Marfa warily reopened. Last summer, as cases in Texas spiked, Governor Greg Abbott claimed an overlooked loophole in his emergency orders allowed local governments to require businesses to require customers to wear masks. Confused, city and county officials across the state soon scrambled to reimpose such rules. Marfa started requiring masks again in June, with other cities like Alpine adopting similar rules shortly after. The policy change was convoluted to even explain, because the state rules, at least according to Governor Abbott, hadn't changed at all. Texas Monthly likened the guidance to a riddle. It was a fitting example of how state leaders have responded to the coronavirus crisis in Texas, where limited resources, confusing guidance, and misinformation have at times made a bad situation even worse. But if the pandemic was marred by state and national mismanagement, if it often felt like the needs and wants of Tri-County residents were being ignored by faraway leaders, the story was the opposite on the local level, where city and county officials worked hard to serve and protect their constituents. City and county officials worked around the changing state guidance, constantly adjusting and refining rules and guidance that worked for their communities. Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara, among others, helped ensure that far-flung communities like Presidio weren't forgotten in testing and vaccination efforts. In Marfa, city officials, led by Councilmember Buck Johnston and City Attorney Teresa Todd, helped organize local contact tracing, the first program of its kind in small-town rural Texas. Nor will Tri-County residents soon forget the efforts of health officials like Dr. Edka Escobar, who did their best to collect and present relevant coronavirus data in clear and calm tones. Unfortunately, there was only so much local officials could do. For months, residents relied on irregular testing sites organized by the Texas Division of Emergency Management. Many residents complained of long wait times for results, that is, when testing was even available. The state poured millions into third-party vendors to help organize the sites and process the tests. But some of those companies produced questionable results. One company, Hanu, had to cancel a testing site in Alpine because it wasn't prepared. Meanwhile, the Food and Drug Administration this year warned of false negatives with the curative mouth swab test, which we used for months in the Tri-County. Fanned on by social media and then President Donald Trump, misinformation also spread throughout the region. In Jeff Davis County in August, at a meeting that was ostensibly about the death of a beloved county judge, residents cheered on each other as they used the public comment period to share conspiracy theories, including the claim that top health experts were war criminals who were profiting from the pandemic. Even when much of the Tri-County started requiring masks again, law enforcement dealt with non-compliance. In Marfa, city officials briefly considered legal action against both Dollar General and Stripes because they weren't following mask ordinances. And at the Sol Ross State University Rodeo in Alpine, a maskless man threatened police officers who were trying to remove him from the venue. In future history books, the pandemic will hardly be the only big topic for 2020. In June, as the country protested and rioted over police killings of black people, Alpine saw its largest protest march in recent memory. Now, finally, 2020 is over, and soon, one hopes, the pandemic will be too. Vaccination efforts have continued in the Tri-County, including a vaccine clinic last week in Marfa. At press time, according to DSHS data, more than 1,400 Presidio County residents have been fully vaccinated, around 3,300, more than half of all residents eligible for the vaccine, have received at least one shot. As spring break kicks off, Texans adjust to latest ban on mask rules, by Stephen Paulson. Big Bend residents might be feeling a sense of deja vu these days. Judging by crowds across the Tri-County, the spring break holidays are in full swing for 2021, just as they seemed to be last year until coronavirus abruptly nixed holiday plans. Meanwhile, just like last spring, Texas state officials have once again barred local officials from adopting mask rules, one of the simplest ways to limit coronavirus spread while keeping the economy open. And while there are some promising signs in Texans' fight against the pandemic, including an accelerating vaccine rollout, some residents and officials worry that just like last year, Texas is declaring victory a little too early. The end of mask rules have been felt differently across the Tri-County. Just like last year, businesses are still free to impose such rules for their own establishments. But with local ordinances like Marfa's mask rule off the table, maskless faces are again showing up at places like Porter's, where masks are no longer required, and a Dollar General, where they still are. Some business owners in the region have been pleasantly surprised to find customers complying with mask rules at their stores and restaurants. But others, including the owner of several gas stations in Presidio, say they're once again dealing with unruly customers who insist that masks are no longer required in Texas. Jose Pratt, a manager at Thunderbird Hotel in Marfa, has been pleased to find his tourist business booming again. He's consistently booked at around 60% for the spring break holidays, he says. with Thunderbird still limiting occupancy due to the pandemic, that's basically full capacity. Like other businesses in tourist-oriented Marfa, Pride has been relieved to see the return of the normal spring break crowd. Business has been slow in recent months as potential tourists canceled trips in reaction to spikes in the region or the sense, fair or not, that Marfa didn't want guests. Now Marfa is starting to feel like it's an old tourist town self again. For the next 2 weeks, Pratt said, we don't have any rooms left. We're super positive and super optimistic, Pratt said this week, reflecting on the visitors who were filling his rooms and the sidewalks in Marfa. We're really happy right now. Thunderbird technically requires masks, though as a hospitality business, Pratt says, we've never been aggressive with it. Still, he's had no problems with customers. I haven't seen a single person walking around the hotel without a mask, he said. The same seems to be largely true for Marfa in general. At the last city council meeting, Steve Marquez, the chief of Marfa Police, encouraged business owners to call if they were dealing with customers who refused to mask up. But so far, he says, no one has called in. We really haven't had any reports, Marquez said in an interview this week. From my perspective, it's been all right. Other business owners say they've also been pleasantly surprised not only with the comeback of Big Bend tourism, but with the ease with which they've been able to enforce mask requirements in their establishments. Compared to last year, when Texas businesses were first left to create mask policies for their own establishments, many say enforcing those policies is easier now. That even includes more conservative parts of the Tri-County, like in Fort Davis, where mask rules have been at times prompted rancor from residents. Jennifer Harrod, co-owner of the Fort Davis drugstore, said she was nervous when Governor Greg Abbott announced this month that he was rolling back state mask rules. Harrod has long had some of the stricter mask rules in Fort Davis. She wanted to keep her employees and customers safe, but worried about lost customers or outbursts from anti-maskers. She spoke to her husband Richard, who co-owns the business, and they agreed they should do the right thing and keep mask rules even when the state order expired. And so far, at least, she said she's faced little pushback from residents or visitors. Earlier this month, the store announced on social media that it was keeping mask rules. In the span of just the last 2 weeks, our town and our staff have lost two dear people to COVID. The post read, "We don't feel now is the time to leave our staff or our guests at risk, so our mask-required signs will stay up." The post saw an overwhelmingly positive response, Harrod said, with almost 300 likes and dozens of supportive comments. There were even some surprising comments from people who were anti-mask, she said. Overall, she says, adopting mask rules has been at worst a wash and maybe even good for business. While she's lost some customers for now, she said she's gained new ones who appreciate her commitment to coronavirus precautions. Meanwhile, like Pratt and Marfa, Harrod has been pleased to see tourist numbers picking up again in the region. Running a hotel and restaurant in Fort Davis, you barely make it through February, she said. March is about digging yourself out of that hole. With coronavirus still going and with the mask mandate expiring, Harrod worried that she would have a repeat of March 2020, when spring break tourism suddenly dried up. Instead, she says, tourists are back in the region, and better yet, they're willing to follow her mask rules. People have been surprisingly respectful, Harrod said. I've only had a couple people that are not nice about it. In Alpine, Brewster County Sheriff Ronnie Dodson says many business owners are continuing to require masks in their establishments, and so far, at least, he has heard a few, if any, outbursts at stores. We've had a couple of incidents, he said, but it was usually people with masks wanting others to have masks on. He figures that by now, pro-mask and anti-mask residents are mostly shopping at stores that align with their own mask values. At his own gun store, Dodson is limiting capacity but decided not to require masks. It's kind of weird to have a guy walk into a gun store with a mask on, he explains. But even still, he says many customers are still masking up, and it's not just the usual suspects. We have some of the staunchest conservative people in the world, Dodson said, and they're wearing masks. But even as the end of the mask mandate goes smoother than expected in much of the Tri-County, there have been exceptions. In Presidio, Ariel Lara, who runs three gas stations, said she's dealt with dozens of customers who have argued with staff over his mask rules. At least twice, the situation escalated to the point where workers had to call Presidio police. Ariel Lara, part owner of the store, claimed he was afraid for the safety of his employees, a police incident report reads. Customers have complained that the governor said Texas is open and there are no more masks in Texas. Lar said, summarizing the complaints he's gotten from anti-mask customers. He'd prefer to keep his mask rules in place to keep his employees safe from coronavirus, but given the incidents, he started to wonder if it would be safer for his workers if they didn't enforce mask rules. John Ferguson, the mayor of Presidio, has heard about complaints from Lara and other residents. Since Governor Abbott ended statewide mask rules, I do not hear anecdotally that mask wearing is not really what it once was, he said. Many of the people who refuse to wear masks, he said, seem to just be passing through town. Presidio continues to embrace mask wearing, and that's to our credit. But unfortunately, a lot of people come from out of town and are like, hey, I'm not doing this anymore. Regardless, some of the lack of complaints can simply be because stores have either ended their mask rules or are no longer enforcing them. Despite Dollar General keeping its mask rules in place, a customer without a mask could be seen on a recent visit. Porter's, the primary grocery store chain in the Tri-County, has stopped requiring masks for customers and is instead simply recommending them. Trey Porter, part of the ownership team at Porter's, said the decision wasn't made lightly and that policies could change, for example, if the region sees another spike. But in a follow-up interview this week, Porter declined to comment on why the store has decided to end its mask requirements. We've moved on from this, he said. I've said all I'm going to say about it. In easing coronavirus restrictions like mask rules, state leaders have often touted their decisions as good for business. But Pratt, the Thunderbird manager, said he's got some cancellations after Texas ended its mask mandate. It really kind of hurt us, he said, noting that Abbott's decision to end the mask mandate, which President Joe Biden characterized as Neanderthal thinking, was painting Texas in a pretty bad light. As Pratt, Herod, and others have learned throughout the pandemic, lax coronavirus rules aren't always what's best for business.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, March the 11th, 2021. PCMH gets J&J vaccine by Nathan Hewer. Beginning March 11th, Pecos County Memorial Hospital will start giving out the Johnson & Johnson single-dose vaccine after receiving their first shipment of shots on March 9th. PCMH received 100 vaccines on Tuesday, and the hospital plans to administer those shots at their clinic on the hospital's campus by way of an appointment. Individuals 18 years old and older can receive the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at PCMH, and those people do not need to be from the area. Individuals who want the shot are asked to call the hospital's clinic number at 432-336-2291 to set up an appointment. PCMH will have their clinic open Monday through Friday, but not on the weekend. The hospital will schedule people in groups of five to get shots to ensure no vacancies are wasted. PCMH in Fort Stockton initially hesitated on getting the vaccine due to the initial information provided on the vaccine's effectiveness. The hospital staff held a meeting on March 9th, and after a thorough review of current information on the vaccine, the hospital decided to go forward with getting the shot. We had a medical staff meeting yesterday, and our physicians are more comfortable with Johnson & Johnson as more information has come out. At first, they were a little hesitant, but as more and more information has come out, they're more confident in that vaccine. Briscoe added that the hospital is unsure when they'll receive more Johnson & Johnson vaccines after they give out their initial 100, but the hospital CEO believes the facility will receive them on a consistent basis. The 100 J&J vaccines, along with additional Pfizer vaccines, will be the only first-shot vaccines out this week or next, as PCMH is currently catching up on their second-dose vaccines. Pfizer vaccines are for ages 16 and older. PCMH will hold a vaccine clinic at the Pecos County Civic Center for second-dose shots on March 17th and March 20th. Individuals who received their first dose shot at the Civic Center on February 24th will receive their second shots on Wednesday, March 17th from 9 to 5. Those who received their first shot on February 20th will receive their second vaccine on Saturday, March 20th from 9 to noon. PCMH will continue to administer shots at the Civic Center in Fort Stockton until the end of the month before strictly using the clinic at the hospital's campus to give out shots. The number of active COVID cases has maintained below 20 people since February 16th in Pecos County. And on Tuesday, March 9th, it was reported there were only 6 active cases in the county. The total is the lowest number of active cases since September 24th. COVID-19-related hospitalizations have also plummeted, as there have no reservations of Pecos County hospitals hospitalized since March 3rd. The drop in active cases coincides with the rise in number of COVID-19 vaccines that have been given in the county and Fort Stockton. There have been 4,078 residents of Pecos County that have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. That's 33% of the amount of people that live in the county that are old enough to get a vaccine. County opens up facilities by Nathan Heuer. Pecos County Commissioners decided to follow suit with Governor Abbott's executive order at the group's regular meeting on Monday, March 8th. The commissioners unanimously decided to make county facilities available for rent starting on Wednesday, March 10th. We're going to go 100% capacity, Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster said. Everywhere is optional to wear a mask, including when somebody rents a building, it's optional to the people. Some people will wear them and some won't. All county facilities will be allowed to be at 100% capacity except for the large community hall at Rooney Park, a facility that is set at 75% capacity for the time being. The commissioner of that precinct, Robert Gonzalez, said the facility will likely increase to 100% in the next month or two, pending on vaccination rates and active cases in the county. The decision comes 17 days before the Comanche Spring Rodeo, which is scheduled for March 25th to 27th. The event will be allowed to be at 100% capacity, and it is up to individuals in attendance as to whether they will wear a mask. One facility that will keep their mask requirement in place is the Pecos County Courthouse. Schuster stated that he polled county employees, and the consensus was that they felt it was best to leave the mask requirement in their building in place for the time being. Everybody is still in favor of leaving the mask requirements up at the door to get into the office. To me, all of our employees have got their second vaccinations. Myself and my belief, I agree with other people, the persons and the other people in the other county offices, to keep the mask requirement for the next 4 to 5 weeks, and then I'll look at it at that time. The judge iterated that individual businesses in Fort Stockton and Pecos County have the right to demand a mask or face covering in their facility, and if not followed, can deny a person the right to purchase goods or receive service in their building. Abbott's order specifically states that individuals are strongly encouraged to wear face coverings over the nose and mouth wherever it is not feasible to maintain 6 feet of social distancing from another person not in the same household. But no person may be required by any jurisdiction to wear or to mandate the wearing a face covering in all counties not in an area with high hospitalizations, which is defined by the order of an area that has 7 consecutive days in which the COVID-19 hospitalized patients as a percentage of total hospital capacity exceeds 15%. Entities that statement will not apply to include schools, jails, medical, and long-term care facilities. Pecos County Memorial Hospital made a statement on Facebook that masks will continue to be required at all medical fitness centers. An inside look at the Comanche Tortilla and Tamale Factory by Jeremy Gonzalez. The Texas Country Reporter was in Fort Stockton Tuesday, March 4th, filming inside the Comanche Tortilla and Tamale Factory. The Texas-based show will be running the segment sometime next season, which will be the 50th season of Texas Country Reporter. When we found out about the Comanche Tortilla and Tamale Factory, we knew we had to make a trip to Fort Stockton to visit the Guerreros family, producer Ben Hartman said. Hosts Bob and Kelly Phillips met with Ben Gallegos, 93, and his 5 sons. Having Ben and all 5 of his sons show up really made the day special and made for an exciting day of filming, revealed Hartman. Kelly interviewed Ben, and Bob interviewed J.B. Gallegos, who took over the family business after his father and grandfather. I wanted to have all of my brothers involved with this. I called them and said every one of us have worked at the factory. Whether we want to or not, we're here. Sometimes you tried to get fired, but the next day you were back working just as hard, if not even harder. The current owner of the Comanche factory continued by stating the business has always been about family and will continue to be. This was a family thing. The same goes for making tamales. It's a family thing. That's something that will be emphasized in the show, and that's what I want to pass along in the future of this factory. I want to start teaching classes here on how to make tamales. When you make tamales, you have somebody working the corn husks, the men out there cooking the meat, and even the kids could get involved. It's a family affair, and that's what this factory represents. Ben has not stepped foot inside the factory in over a year. With his five sons united, the filming session was also a reunion in many ways. The three film crews began shooting at 9 a.m. with the two hosts arriving about 2 to conduct the interviews. JB says TCR photographer Dan Strickland sets the schedule and is aiming to have the segment aired in November. With no confirmed release date, Fort Stockton residents can look forward to seeing the Comanche Tortilla and Tamale Factory showcased in the 50th season of Texas Country Reporter. PCSB announces promotions. The directors of Pecos County State Bank recently announced 4 promotions in Fort Stockton. Bill McAnally has been promoted to Executive Vice President. He began at the bank in 2013, where he also serves as an advisory director to the board and as the primary agricultural loan officer. Bill and his wife Delia have lived in Fort Stockton since 1995. Amy Roberts Ontiveros has been promoted to Senior Vice President and Cashier. She began working at the bank in 1999 while in high school as a VOE student. Amy is married to James Ontiveros and his 2 sons. Lisa Chavarria has been promoted to Senior Vice President. She began working at Pecos County State Bank in 1981. She and Ruben have been married for 40 years and they have 2 sons. Isaiah Rojas has been promoted to Assistant Vice President. He started his banking career in 2017. Isai is a lifelong resident of Fort Stockton and is married to Tatiana Rojas.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, March 11th. ACLU joins parents as school dress code fight. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Quote, school districts should do what is best for their students, make sure they are not discriminating against any student, and treat all students fairly. We're hoping the Monahan School District will choose to do the right thing and that a drastic remedy like losing federal funding never happens, ACLU attorney Brian Klosterbauer said recently in reference to the ongoing battle between the Monahan's Wicked Paiute School District and several parents regarding the district's dress code. National and Texas American Civil Liberties Union chapters have joined the semester-long battle over the school district's dress and grooming codes. The two entities filed complaints on March 4th with the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Justice's Educational Opportunities Section on behalf of Rebecca Kynes and Desiree Valle's sons, both who claim Native American heritage and wear long hair to reflect their heritage, ancestry, religious beliefs, and identity. While both the boys claim a Native American heritage, Klosterbauer said the complaint is just as much about sex discrimination as well as racial discrimination. Quote, the complaint really focuses both on the impermissible sex discrimination in the written policies as well as how those policies have been enforced against Native American students, he said. In August 2020, the ACLU sent a letter to MWP ISD, as well as over 400 other school districts across the state, asking them to revise dress code policies that it says are, quote, unconstitutional and discriminatory, end quote. Both Kynes and Valle have gone through the lengthy grievances procedure set up by MWP ISD policies, but have received no response. Klosterbauer said, quote, "Both parents have exhausted the grievance process with the school district, but have not received a response, so the complaints filed last week are asking the two federal civil rights agencies to open an investigation and look into this and try to help remedy the situation," end quote. According to the preliminary statement on the complaint, quote, "MWP ISD's hair length policy prohibits boys, but not girls, from wearing long hair, and the district has refused to change this policy or grant either boy an exception, despite the parents exhausting every level of MWP ISD's internal grievance process. If the Kynes and Valle boys were girls, MWP ISD would allow them to wear long hair without repercussion. But because they are boys, MWP ISD's policy mandates that they cut their hair. The district's requirement that boys, but not girls, cut their long hair in order to attend school plainly violates Title IX of the Educational Amendments," end quote. Title IX is a broad remedial statute enacted to eradicate gender inequality and stereotypes in education. Quote, "I really had hopes the board would have taken the time to understand the importance of this issue for my family and other families in our district. The lack of concern and respect for district families has forced us to take these measures," Rebecca Kynes said. Both Tatum and Sudirth Elementary Schools have identical dress and grooming codes in their student handbooks, which have been approved by the MWP ISD Board of Trustees. With regard to hair and facial hair, the dress code in part states, "Boys' hair must be cut as not to touch the eyebrows in front or extend beyond the top of the collar of a standard shirt and back. Additionally, boys' hair may not exceed the top of the ear, and boys are not allowed to wear hair and a ponytail." Quote, "We are aware of the complaint filed and are in conversation with our attorney. As stated in the fall, we are forming committees at each campus to address our dress code moving forward," Superintendent of Schools Chad Smith said. In response to issues raised by parents and students regarding the school's dress policy, especially the hair policy, Smith said in the February 22nd school board meeting that committees would be formed. "The committees are being formed at each school campus to address the current school dress code policy." Klosterbauer said the district, quote, "might initiate a process to reconsider the discriminatory policies is not good enough. Ultimately, the district will have to change policies to conform to federal law. It cannot maintain the policies that are clearly illegal and unconstitutional. We're still hopeful the school will update their policies as soon as possible," he said. One possible remedy is to pull the federal funding the district accepts from the United States Department of Education, and in doing so, binds it to federal law. Quote, "That would be a drastic remedy, but is something the federal government could do. Typically with these complaints, almost every school district chooses to comply and update their policy," he said. The U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Justice's Educational Opportunities Section will work with the district to find a solution. Quote, "We're hoping an investigation is opened and the district will voluntarily comply and work with the federal government to make sure the policies conform to federal law," he added. These regulations specifically prohibit schools from, quote, "subjecting any person to separate or different rules on the basis of sex," Klosterbauer said. The complaint also alleges MWP ISD has engaged in impermissible retaliation by sending MWP ISD Chief of Police Orlando Orona to Valle's house, where he allegedly told her that she needed to, quote, "drop the hair issue," unquote, or she would be banned from campus, after Valle sent an email to the school complaining that his dress and grooming policies constituted impermissible sex discrimination. Quote, "This threat profoundly affected and intimidated Valle and her son, and having a police officer threaten a parent's ability to come to campus and attend school events would dissuade a reasonable person from continuing to assert their rights under Title IX or Title VI, according to the complaint. Quote, "We're asking the federal agency to investigate the possible retaliation and also hoping the district understands it has a legal obligation to not retaliate against any person who complains of discrimination and that the district will not take any other retaliatory actions in the future," Klosterbauer said. Quote, "We are taking the days as they come, but my son is still fearful that he may get into trouble because we did not receive a response regarding our grievances. I've had to constantly reassure him the district's chief of police will not do anything to him or myself because of his long hair," Desiree Valle said. Decades ago, Texas courts said school districts could treat boys and girls differently when it came to hair, grooming, and dressing requirements. But more recently, federal courts now found that this is unconstitutional. Quote, "The case law is very clear that Native American students have to be treated fairly and cannot be discriminated against for wearing long hair in accordance with their heritage and belief. The case law has also evolved significantly on the gender and sex discrimination, too, compared to the decades-old ruling, and now says it is unconstitutional to treat boys and girls separately based on sex," Klosterbauer said. The families, along with the ACLU, are asking the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights investigate MWPISD to determine whether its dress and grooming code complies with Title IX and Department of Education implementing regulations both on its face and as enforced. Investigate MWPISD to determine whether its dress and grooming code as applied to Native American students violates Title VI and Department of Education implementing regulations. Take all steps necessary to remedy any unlawful conduct as required by Title IX, Title VI, and Department of Education implementing regulations, including, but not limited to, ordering MWPISD to adopt a gender-neutral dress code and train or retrain its employees with respect to unlawful retaliation. Secure assurances of compliance from MWPISD with respect to remedies for any unlawful conduct discovered, and monitor any resulting agreement with MWPISD to ensure compliance. Search yields over 200 grams of THC-laced items. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Ward County Sheriff's deputies served a search warrant at 409 South Gary Street last Friday, seizing more than 200 grams of a substance believed to contain tetrahydrocannabinols, also known as THC. According to Ward County Sheriff Frerin Valle, quote, "The search warrant was obtained during the course of an ongoing investigation," end quote. Deputies seized 247 grams of a substance believed to contain THC. The items seized, believed to contain THC, were wax, vape cartridges, and edibles at the location formerly known as Hair Attitude and Body Shop. Kwandi Carthon, age 42, of Monahans, and Christian Hallman, age 35, of Portage, Michigan, were subsequently arrested and charged with possession of a controlled substance, a second-degree felony. After the arrest, Carthon said, quote, "I have taken the necessary steps to try to get legal and obtain my medical marijuana license for my ADHD medicine, even though it is still not legal in Texas. This is a travesty for people that really need and use THC as a medicine for serious medical issues," the charges I received would not have even been considered in one of the border states. I've gone through the right channels as far as obtaining a medical card, and have been medically cleared to consume the THC medicine. Going to jail for a sucker with 225 grams of sugar and 1 actual gram of THC, but being charged like it's 226 grams of a controlled substance is absurd. Just as our local school dress and hair policy needs to be updated, so does the marijuana laws that continue to take loved ones away. End quote. Carthen produced what he said was the Marijuana Medical Cannabis Program Patient Identification Card, issued by the New Mexico Department of Health, with an expiration date of November 2022. States neighboring Texas allow marijuana use recreationally, or at least medicinally, including Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. In fact, Texas even goes a step further by penalizing the possession of THC edibles even more harshly than it does for marijuana-related offenses. According to Texas law, THC edibles, gummies, lollipops, and similar products are considered to be in a different penalty category than marijuana, which means the consequences of getting caught with even just a bag of THC gummy bears is a felony. If convicted, Carthen and Hallman could face 2 to 20 years in prison and a fine of up to $10,000. City contract renewed with Delcom. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. City council members met on Tuesday for a relatively short meeting, and after establishing a quorum and approving previous minutes, tax roll adjustments, accounts payable, and the monthly departmental reports, the council approved renewing a contract with Delcom for use of the 8th Street Tower. Delcom has utilized the city water tower since 2015, when the council first agreed to allow the company to place antennas on the tower in exchange for a broadband service to the police department, municipal court, and city hall. The contract was up for renewal after 5 years. Quote, "The new contract is basically the same as the previous one, where the city will pay reduced costs for charges for internet services for police department, municipal court, and city hall in exchange for allowing Delcom to utilize the tower," City Manager Rex Thee said. The reduced amount comes to about $300, which Thee said, quote, "would not be adequate for a lease on the tower, but the value in the contract is the increase in speed and megabyte up to 50 for the police department and up to 70 for the city we would be able to use," end quote. City Attorney Alan Nicholas reviewed the contract and only had minor changes, which Delcom had agreed to verbally, Thee added. In other business, residents in Monahans will see a slight increase in their natural gas bill based on the Texas Gas Service annual reporting requirement per rate schedule by the Texas Railroad Commission. Quote, "The increase is to help recoup costs for the pipeline integrity and testing upgrades. This is something that is done each year," Thee said. "The increase amounts to about 1 cent per month." The Texas Railroad Commission allows Texas Gas to recoup $52,000. The action was approved. In second and final readings, the removal of 408 West Seeley from the fire zone was also approved by the council. A public hearing was held in February to remove Lot 6, less than 1 foot, all of Lot 7, 8, 9 of Block 9 of Monahan's original town addition, 408 West Seeley, from the fire zone. Thee told the council at the time of the hearing the reason for the request of the removal was to put a temporary building on the lot to open a sandwich shop. If the restaurant proved successful, the petitioner, Ruben Arroyo, stated the possibility of building a permanent building on the lot, end quote. Members of the public were present for the hearing, but no one had any comments on the request. Mask mandate ends, cases drop. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Active COVID-19 cases in Ward County and across the state continue to drop. As of Wednesday morning, County Judge Greg Holly said there were 26 active cases, 660 confirmed cases, 467 probable, 1,080 recovered, and 21 deaths. No new deaths have been reported in the past week. A week ago, there were 39 active cases. Statewide, there were 128,000 active cases, down from 154,000 a week ago. There have been 2.3 million confirmed cases statewide, 367,841 probable, and 44,659 deaths. DSHS did not report the number of recoveries. In Monday's meeting of the County Commissioners, the attendance guidelines for facilities was revised to allow up to 100% capacity. As of Wednesday, the statewide mandate requiring masks was rescinded, and businesses, such as restaurants and bars, are now allowed to operate at 100% capacity. But Holly noted that establishments still have the right to require face masks in their establishments. Quote, "The order doesn't prevent businesses from imposing their own restrictions in their place of business. A business may require face masks if they desire, and I assume many will do so, especially large chains. Please be considerate of clerks who have no involvement in those decisions." Quote, "The order doesn't establish the operating rules for schools, nursing homes, or jail facilities. It states that each of these will be guided by their respective state agencies," Holly said. Another round of about 250 COVID-19 shots was distributed on Tuesday morning at the Ward County Coliseum, bringing the total to over 1,500 in the county. Jail, courthouse to get new security cameras. The story was read by Paul Cyphers. Ward County Jail and the county courthouse will soon have new security cameras after the commissioners approved the only bid received in Monday's regular meeting. The bid from Sedaptic Incorporated of Waco for $156,000 will provide improved video security cameras at the jail and add new cameras to the exterior of the courthouse. Sheriff Freyran Valle said, quote, "The current system has several blind spots, especially around the trash bins, as we have had instances of people hiding contraband there. There are also blind spots in the booking area, and this system also has infrared capability. What we have currently is obsolete," end quote. County Judge Greg Holly added, quote, "We have security cameras on the inside of the courthouse, but not on the outside. This expenditure is budgeted," end quote. Holly updated the court on the order rescinding the face mask mandate that was to go into effect on March 10th. Quote, "In addition to eliminating the mask mandate, it also eliminates the occupancy limit, allowing business to now operate at 100%. However, some entities will remain under their organization directives. For example, schools will follow directives from the TEA, the Texas Education Agency, and jails will follow directives from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. There has also been negative effects with the shutdown, such as the impact on courts and the resultant hardship on the community. Jury trials have been put on hold, and this has led to jail overcrowding and has affected the rights of defendants to a speedy trial. Courts are scheduled to reopen in April. Locally, jury selection will be at the event center, and during the trials, plexiglass will be used to protect jurors. Commissioners agreed to reopen county facilities, including the event center, coliseum, and community centers, to 100% but not change any events already scheduled. In other action, the bid from Tejas Bank for a county depository contract for registry funds held by the county and district courts was accepted. No other bids were received. "We have a great relationship with Tejas and have been great to work with," County Treasurer Teresa Stoner said. The monthly treasurer's report from Treasurer Teresa Stoner was approved. Total cash and other assets as of February 28th was $81.7 million. Beginning balance was $71.5 million. Stoner's report was her last as county treasurer, as she is retiring on March 12th. The commissioners honored her with a plaque presentation to commemorate her years of service. A reception in her honor was held on Friday. Carly Ennis has been appointed to fill Stoner's unexpired term. She will be given the oath of office at 10 a.m. on Saturday, March 13th. In other business, the outdoor burn ban was renewed for another 90 days, despite moisture received from recent snow. Fire danger remains high, with a drought index of 637 on a scale of 800, which is moderate to severe drought conditions. The ban prohibits burning in unincorporated areas of the county. Burning of household trash and containers covered by metal grating, outdoor cooking, or burning in metal pits and grills, or other outdoor burning activities is permitted by the Ward County Fire Marshal. Commissioners present for the meeting were Tino Sanchez, Larry Hanna, Dexter Nichols, and Eddie Nelms. Additionally, Judge Greg Holly was also in attendance. The next meeting of the commissioners will be at 9:30 a.m. on March 22nd in the commissioners' courtroom of the Ward County Courthouse at 400 South Allen Street. Here is an obituary that appeared in the Monahans News on March 11th. Jerry Donald Roberts passed away on February 23rd. He was predeceased by his wife of 63 years, Gloria Jean Roberts, Mark Allen Roberts, his eldest son, Walter S. Roberts, his father, Martha Nell Roberts, his mother, Howard James Roberts, his brother, Marie George, his sister, as well as extended family and many friends. Left behind to cherish his memory include his daughter, Rebecca Lynn Waddell, and his favorite son-in-law, Ron, his son, Ronald Ray Roberts, as well as grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. J.D. was born, went to school, and spent his lifetime in Monahans. During his school years, he met Gloria Jean Young and fell hopelessly in love. They married in 1958 and raised their family in Monahans. During his young life, J.D. became a licensed electrician and worked for Monahans Electric Motors for most of his life.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.